Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
KVOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Festicide, a three-day anti-festival taking place in venues all over Portland on August 21st through 23rd. Festicide celebrates Portland's DIY culture with an emphasis on punk, metal, and extreme music. There will be 9 shows across town over the three-day weekend with performances by Danova, Uncool Niece, Jenny Doe and the Spurs, Rabbits, The Woolen Men, VX Gas Attack, and many, many more. Again, that's Festicide, August 21st through 23rd, at venues all over Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hi, jazz lovers. This is Mike. I wanted to tell you about my new podcast that just went live on KBOO website. It's called Unsung Heroes of Jazz, where every week we'll feature an artist who recorded between the 1940s and the 1960s, so-called golden era of jazz, but for whatever reason never really got the recognition they so richly deserved. We'll tell you a little bit about them, play some of their music. Some of them you will have heard of, some of them you won't, but in all cases they certainly deserve more recognition than they got. We think it's a different wrinkle, and we hope you'll enjoy it and really hope you'll join us. Thank you.
The time is 7:01 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned now for episode 11 of The River Signal.
The River Signal.
Long dash following 10 seconds of silence. 5 days in the sky.
This summer, three of us, Galen, Brian, and Reed, are traveling down the Mississippi on the Channel Princess, a 30-foot paddlewheel riverboat. As we go, we're meeting musicians and recording them on boats and riverbanks, and then weaving their music into a serialized radio story. We pull together every episode of The River Signal in just 7 days, all while moving downriver and trying not to sink the boat.
The River Signal is fiction, set in a sort of weird alternate reality. And the world of each episode is inspired by the music we hear and the people we meet. We chose fiction because we don't quite believe in true travel stories. And we hope that by writing an obviously fictional account of our trip, we'll show how subjective travel stories can be.
This week, we tie up to a derelict dock just north of downtown St. Louis. We travel between the city and the boat along a riverfront bike path, passing beneath bridges, by barge stations, and huge heaps of scrap metal. The size of the city shocks the small town sensibilities we've developed on the northern stretch of the river, but we jump into the fold and find a variety of amazing musicians. On a sweltering afternoon, Bo clambers down a mud bank and joins us to sing and play guitar on the boat. The next evening, Prasanna and Seema meet us in the St. Paul Church, where they sing and drum the scales and rhythms of classical music from India. And 12 hours later, we're deep in the bowels of the City Museum, a labyrinthine funhouse jungle gym scraped together from pieces of the old city. Beside the spiraling 10-story slide, we record Dave Stevens, who plays classical St. Louis tunes on an immense theater organ. This eclectic selection of music, along with the diverse nature of the cityscape, is the inspiration for this week's episode.
Episode 11, The Exchange.
Probably. Dante here, broadcasting from the biggest barge on the highway. It's going to be a busy day on the St. Louis. When I woke up, a dozen junk rafts and sailboats were already tied on. And word has it, we'll see a flotilla of Venetians by midday. Probably packing sweet corn and sheet metal, and all sorts of goodies from the Northern Territories. Now, we've still got a copper glut, so hold on to your pipes and wires. But if you have any boots, or even just a boot, then, well, look at that. A weird little paddle wheeler's pulling up beside my porthole. I gotta say, the hull looks pretty rough, and so does the crew. Fellow traders, you might consider passing these guys some food or clothes, or at the very least, some soap. Trust me, it's for your own good. Wow, the St. Louis. I remember the first time we heard about this place. We were still on the Crow Wing, hanging out with Kitty Rocket, which, if you listen to the signal, I'm sure I don't even need to tell you about Kitty. That lady's a legend. Anyway, Kitty was as kind as anyone we've met on the highway, but even she said she'd be surprised if we got this far.
Well, Kitty, if you're listening, we're here. We made it. The St. Louis is bigger than any barge train I've seen, maybe 20 containers long. Everyone's dented and rust crater. It doesn't look real inviting, but then again, what does out here? I tie a line to the barge and follow Reed up a ladder to the deck. Halfway, I stop and look back. Huckins is on the bow of our boat, just staring into the distance. I ask if he's coming with, but he says, "Nah, I'll watch over the princess." I'm about to poke fun at him for being a boring worrywart, but then I remember the flood and the exploding windmill and all the other times we nearly lost the boat. So I just say, "Thanks," and head up the ladder. Nobody's out on the barge deck. It's just a bunch of tables and shelves covered in filthy tarps. But there are all sorts of voices coming from down inside the barge. Reed opens the first hatch we come to and climbs down the ladder. I follow him and, wow, I've been to exchanges before, but this place is amazing. The ceiling's plastered with rusty ducts and piping, and fires burn in every corner. Old men lord over scrap heaps, young girls on tricycles hawk books and loaves of bread, and the air's a mix of fried fish and wood smoke and cinnamon and sweaty feet. I don't even know where to start exploring. I turn to ask Reed what he thinks, but he's gone. Oh well. Probably just looking for harpoons anyway. I walk through the barge, taking everything in. Up in those scrap piles, there are quite a few salvageable bikes. Maybe I can finally replace Big Guy, the bike Huckins broke. I'm trying to figure out what I might offer for trade when I hear music. A guy's playing guitar by a fire in the far corner. And his voice sounds familiar. Like my Uncle Carl, who was a real good singer, well, before the chainsaw incident. I walk on over, find a shadowed spot along the wall, and listen. I stand up and look around. There's no one else watching. And crap, now he's looking at me and I feel awkward, so I tell him I like his music and that the other traders don't know what they're missing and that his voice makes me think of my dear dead uncle. And this is when he interrupts to say, "I'm Bo, and you must be the envoy." Before I can even ask how he knows my name, Bo points at my shirt and says, "She told me you'd be wearing flannels." "She?" I ask. "Anna," Bo says. "You two did meet in Superior Land, right?" I do my best to just nod and look casual, but I'm kind of freaking out. Her name is Anna, and she's been talking about me. Bo sticks out his hand. When I go to shake it, he slips something into my palm. Anna wanted you to have this, he says. And then he holds on, gripping too tight for too long. And I don't like the look he's giving me. When Bo does let go, I see that he's passed me a blue scrap of paper, folded in half. She wrote me a letter. I go to open it, but Bo grabs my wrist. I'm gonna have to ask you to read that elsewhere, he says. I did my part, passing you Anna's little message, but now I'm done with her. I'm done with the caboose. Wait, I say. The lost caboose? Only caboose I know of, Bo says. He picks up a piece of driftwood and tosses it on the fire. Look, he says, I'm not sure why Anna's writing to you or what you think you know about the caboose, but I'm telling you, stay away from that thing. It is a death trap. I look down at the letter in my hands. I want to open it so bad. But I shove it in my pocket and look up at Bo and ask, why? He shakes his head. Buddy, he says, I'd rather not talk about it. All I can tell you is, I'm glad I got off while I could. Who knows if that thing will even surface again? When Bo sees the look on my face, he rolls his eyes. You do know the caboose is a submarine, right? Well, now I've got a million more questions. But before I can ask any of them, an old man walks up. He drops a can of beans into Bo's hat, then points at the guitar and snaps his fingers. I'm gonna stay right here on the St. Louis, Bo says as he plucks the strings. You should too. If you keep chasing the caboose and making noise in the signal, I guarantee the howl's gonna catch up with you. I try to ask him what the howl even is, but he just looks down at the guitar and starts to sing. While Bo plays, I take slow backward steps. And as soon as I'm in the shadows, out of sight, I open the letter.
Envoy, I'm sorry I couldn't wait for you. The howl's been worse than ever, and we've had to stay on the move. But I promise I'll meet you at the confluence in the cave behind the swing. And if none of this makes sense yet, don't worry. For better or worse, it all will soon. No, I don't lie. And after this ship just in time, across the globe, a dozen fires burn gently by open doors, the room filled up with echoes of us laughing at the world unknown, but they still knew us, knew our secret lives were gaining all this motion. Bet your last whole dollar that we saw. Just in time.
muskrat. It's only been a matter of minutes since I left the boat, and already I'm completely lost. There doesn't seem to be much rhyme or reason to the layout of this barge. It's as though these passageways were built over generations, piece by piece with whatever materials were available. I've crossed wooden bridges, scaled rebar ladders, and slid down concrete chutes, and it's only got me deeper into this floating labyrinth. That organ music seems to be coming out of the cement pipe. The opening is just big enough to squeeze through, so I drop on all fours and I crawl inside. I'm not sure this was intended to be a passageway. It's dark and wet, and it sounds like something is skittering about in here, but I can see light at the far end. The tube opens up into an immense hall. Mounted on the walls is a vast assortment of organ pipes, and directly below, I can see the organist playing. His fingers bounce over tiered keyboards, while his feet walk out the bass line on huge wooden pedals. It sounds like he's playing 16 instruments at once. In the middle of the room, there's a large group of people who are sitting around a wood barrel. A man stands and walks towards the center, carrying with him a small box. He sets the box on top of the barrel, opens the lid, and announces he has 1 pound of pepper kernels. A murmur arises from the crowd, and 4 other people pop up, each setting an item on top of the barrel. The man inspects every offer carefully, finally selecting a wool coat that fits him perfectly. He hands over his pepper box, pounds the top of the barrel with a closed fist, and the next in line approaches with a new offer. In my village, barter circles were common. I was always making little toy boats to exchange for sinkers, nets, and other bits that folks brought to trade. As I make my way to the edge of the circle, an old woman hobbles over to the barrel. From a satchel strung around her hip, she pulls out a golden lump. Beeswax! Back home, we constantly used wax to patch leaks in our boats. And given the tattered state of the Channel Princess, this stuff could be a lifesaver. I hustle as fast as I can, but several others are already crowding around the barrel, anxious to trade for this rare commodity. I wedge my way in, and I find myself beside a beautiful girl with a silver streak in her hair. It seems she's brought nothing to trade. The old woman combs through the offers. When she asks the girl with the silver streak what she's brought to barter, the girl smiles and says, "A song." I expect the woman to shrug her off too, but then she nods and tells her to have out with it.
Scrape them scales on the stony riverside. Shimmer as they sink into the cold, dark bed. Make fillets neath the pale moonshine. Sprinkle them with spice to delight. Scrape them scales on the stony riverside.
That's my Nana's song. She used to sing it while cleaning each day's catch of fish. I haven't heard it since I left home.
Neath the pale moonshine, sprinkle them with spice to delight.
When the girl with the silver streak finishes, the old woman hands her the wax without hesitation. The girl curtsies and turns on her heels, and just before she strides away, she turns to me and winks. She's fast, and before I can get her attention, she disappears through a small hole in the ground. I have no idea where it leads, or even if I'll fit, but I ignore my better sense and jump into the opening. Now I'm sliding down a steep pipe, corkscrewing around and around, and just before I lose my fish, I'm ejected from the tube. When I look up, She's standing over me, grinning. "You must really want some wax," she says. "What I want," I say, "is to know where you learned my Nana's song." The girl rubs some wax in her palms and runs it through her braid, and then she says, "From my own grandmother, same as you. All the river elders know it." "You're from North Bend too?" I ask. She nods and shows me the North Star tattooed on her wrist. I'm about to ask what she's doing all the way down here when she sticks the beeswax into a pocket deep in the folds of her dress. "Would you mind lending me a bit?" I ask. "My boat's in rough shape." She smiles, and for a second, I think she's going to give me some wax. But she just says, "Sorry, friend. I need every bit of this if I'm going to properly waterproof my harpoons." When she sees the look on my face, she smiles even wider. "Oh, don't look so surprised," she says. "Do you really think the elders would entrust just one boy with spearing the carp?" Before I can reply, she adds, "I've been following the muck trails in my canoe, same as you. I've hit that fish with half a dozen spears, and I intend to slay it." With that, she turns and heads for the ladder on the opposite wall. Halfway up, she looks back over her shoulder and says, "Good luck with your leaky boat." For a few seconds, I just sit there, bewildered. I can't tell whether I want to kiss her or sink her canoe. I push to my feet and head for the ladder. I've got to get back to the boat. The carp will be mine.
The beginning of the long dash following 10 seconds of silence indicates exactly 12 noon Central Daylight Time.
If you spend long enough listening to the signal, you start to think of it as a place with physical dimensions, like a room or a series of rooms. But it's not some faraway land, it's right here. Layered on top of you, like a wire outline hanging in space. I've been sitting on the Channel Princess for hours, listening to the signal. By now, I feel like I can almost see those layers, like the signal is slowly coming into focus, and the boat I'm on is slowly fading away. When I was little, my brother liked to torture me with stories of ghosts that lived in the old mill buildings. He'd work up these elaborate tales about who they were and how they died. And at night, he'd hide in the brick rubble and make spooky noises. Once I ran to my mother in terror, and she took me outside and pointed into the dark. "See this ghost here?" I nodded, though I could see nothing. "It can't touch you. It doesn't even know you exist." She held my elbow and moved my arm through the air. "See," she said, "your hand goes right through it. You can move through both worlds, but a ghost can only live in one."
Calling relay at River Mile 647. I'm tracking wagon encampment moving down towards a delta, probably near Ferris.
Relay 647, message back. We have no reports from Ferris. You can try the groundskeeper at River Mile 551, but we've been getting nothing but interference down there.
Calling groundskeeper at River Mile 551.
If you're trying to reach out that far, you're going to need a lot more power. We've been getting nothing but loops and hisses from the 400s since last month.
This time, when the signal goes out, it stays out. I go through it all again. Try to bring up a mental map of the river and all the places I've contacted or tried to contact. I know my parents are on land, headed south along the banks of the river, but I have no idea where. And the signal seems to be getting weaker every day. Hardly anything is getting through. There's just no way to transmit down there. I keep spinning the dial and getting nothing. When something does come in, it's just that automated time station at River Mile 400.
The beginning of the long dash following 10 seconds of silence indicates exactly...
I heard this earlier today, but I skipped right past it. But now it's broadcasting the same numbers. Exactly the same, and they're way off. It's almost sunset.
The beginning of the long dash following...
The realization comes slowly. Not a jolt of inspiration, but a prickling sensation of heat that starts at my fingers and moves up my forearm. I know what I'm hearing. It's not the time, it's a loop.
The beginning of the long dash following 10 seconds.
Everyone out here treats these loops as just another interference. But I know something they don't. I know who's making them. The sound of voices overhead pulls me from my signal-induced trance. I look up and see three women rolling up canvas on the St. Louis. I'd been so focused on that loop that I hadn't noticed the storm clouds creeping over the horizon. But now I see them and I can feel the wind rising. I wonder where Reed and the envoy are. When this storm hits, I'm going to need their help. I duck back inside the boat. That storm is coming on, and already I can hear the interference creeping into the signal. I can almost feel it on the dial, too, a faint vibration on the raw tips of my fingers. Like a safecracker feeling for invisible tumblers. I don't know if our radio's strong enough to transmit all the way down to 400, but I've got to try. This is my one chance to warn my parents. The wind is rising. In my peripheral vision, I can see crates and boards flying off the barge, but my eyes don't move from the radio. Before the signal can die out completely, I pick up the transmitter.
Mom, Dad, it's me. I'm alive, and I found him. He's coming your way, so be careful.
The beginning of the long dash following 10 seconds of silence indicates exactly...
Nothing happens for a moment. And then, it catches.
Mom, Dad, it's me. I'm alive.
I lean close to the radio. The howl's getting crazy, hammering the Channel Princess and chopping up the signal. But I can hear my voice just barely, broadcasting from hundreds of miles away. My own message in a bottle.
I'm alive, and I found him.
Reed and the envoy barge into the cabin. Looks like neither of them got anything from the exchange. And they both seem pretty anxious to get moving. Out the portal, I see a whole stand of melons crash and roll off into the water. The signal is gone completely now, and the water is chopping and slamming us up against the barge. Reed monkeys up the cable and unties the line, and the current rips us out into the channel. We run hard into the wind, barely staying off the shore as we're knocked around by low, rolling waves. The haze is thick down here, and the lights from the St. Louis fade to a soft,
distant glow. I can't see either bank of the river now, just haze. But when I close my eyes, I can imagine the river laid out in front of us. I see a constellation of dull lights up and down the banks, and somewhere out there, my own beacon. It's a low flash of light and a faint flicker of electricity,
Mom, Dad, it's me,
making its way through the haze.
This episode of The River Signal was written and recorded by Galen Huckins, Brian Benson, and Reed Lustig. Audio editing by Jill Schupak. Special thanks to Big Money Mike, Bowen the Locomotive, Nick Garcia, Jared Gastrike, Lane Logue, Prasanna and Seema Kasturi, Katie Montgomery, Terry Rose, Dennis Scott, Dave Stevens, Anna Vodica, Wahid, Howard, and everyone else at the Mary Meacham Freedom Crossing and Rest Area, City Museum, St. Paul Church, Ear Trumpet Labs, and KBOO 90.7. For pictures and video of the riverboat trip, check out riversignal.com. Thanks for listening. Stick around for more about our time in St. Louis, and tune in next week for episode 12.
The first thing we notice about St. Louis isn't the arch, or the blues clubs, or the pretty red brick buildings. It's the current. Just before entering the city, we pass through the last of the locks and dams, and just like that, we're going 10 miles per hour, which, though it probably sounds like nothing, is real fast for our tiny paddle wheeler. Our first night in town, we tie up to a massive abandoned pier north of the city. It seems like a great spot. All sorts of walkways and staircases covered in a rainbow of rust. But when we try to head to shore, it doesn't go so well. Just to get to the bike path, we've got to tiptoe through a quarter mile of poison ivy and shin-deep mud. And then it's an 8-mile ride to downtown. The next morning, I take a sort of reconnaissance ride, looking for a spot closer to town. St. Louis is a notoriously difficult place to dock a boat, so mainly I come up empty. But as I'm heading back along the riverfront trail, past crumbling buildings and trash heaps and sewage treatment plants, I pass a big gray pole barn. A bunch of guys wave and yell from inside. I stop and I'm greeted by Howard and Wahid. They work here, improving the trail and greeting folks who stop in. The place, they tell me, is called the Mary Meacham Freedom Crossing and Rest Area, once a key crossing for runaway slaves headed from Missouri into Illinois. Howard and Wahid are super friendly. They offer me water, give me some fishing tips, and invite me back for a barbecue in a few days. And when I mention I'm on a boat and looking for a place to tie up, they point me to the little cove behind the rest area. A few hours later, we've motored down and anchored in that cove. And the next afternoon, after building a rock walkway through the shoreline mud, we welcome Bo of Bo and the Locomotive onto the boat. It's a blistering hot day, but Bo's used to it. He grew up here. He pulls out his acoustic guitar and plays a great set.
Something that I started, I cut off my hair and did not beg your pardon. And I danced alone. Everything that I got, I made sure that I bought it. I never saw luck as something to be proud of. I offered my hand to you and wanted in, and we danced all night. Telling me a story, she says, let's step outside. Much to my surprise, I never heard a story, I just realized. When I come home from the days end with nothing but a dream. She's telling me she loves me. She says I've been so sweet. Well, I could barely breathe. I never wanted anything. I just wanted to.
As it is now, I kind of write the majority of the song lyrics and music and everything, sometimes even drums and bass and all that stuff too, but and then there's also like where I'll bring just a small idea and we'll kind of flush it out, but for the most part they're like songs that I wrote just in my room and recorded and then turned into a band. That's not to discredit the people in my band, because they have a big part of it too. Generally, when I'm writing about something that happened in my life, I'm like far enough removed from it that it's not, I don't have to be totally like, you know, so heavily emotionally involved in it. Sometimes I just write phrases or something that I like, and then later I kind of assign a perspective to it. I don't know if I try and like create an alternate reality, so to speak. I try to keep it as true to myself as I can and write about what I think and what I know. I can tell when I'm writing some lyrics that it's like, this isn't really about me at all, but I like the idea of it. So I don't know if it's still from my perspective in that case or not, but I think it is. The song that I can play next, that's from the perspective of a man who killed his wife's lover, the man she's having an affair with, but he kills the wrong man.
About anyone anymore, but I guess it's hard to tell who's going to hell. Is there something in your eyes that draws me towards you like a pistol to the guy that's been doing you wrong? Some days I can't decide what to do all my time, but there's no reason to complain and nothing to explain. I stand by my belief that everyone has a secret, but I've got nothing to hide. One of us had to die. Sometimes I'm not so sure about anyone anymore, but I guess it's hard to tell who's going to hell. 'Cause there's something in your eyes that draws me towards you like a pistol to the guy that's been doing you wrong. Take my word. fight it out. We'll keep it strange. You are my friend. You are my flame. There is no afraid. No afraid. No
While we're in St. Louis, Reed's partner Katie comes out from Portland for a visit. Her third day in town, we all end up at City Museum, a former shoe factory that's been turned into a sort of scrap heap playground. While Reed and Katie are goofing around on the 10-story slide, they end up in the bowels of the museum, where they find a massive theater organ. Nobody's playing it though, just a computer. Later that day, Reed calls around, trying to find someone who'd be interested in playing a session at City Museum. Dave Stevens, a veteran player and member of the St. Louis Theater Organ Society, says yes. The next morning, we load our gear into backpacks, and with three of us on bikes and one of us riding in a teeny bike trailer, we head back to City Museum, where Dave plays us a medley of classic St. Louis songs.
In downtown St. Louis in the City Museum. What a perfect setting in the atrium of the building for a theater pipe organ. The City Museum is basically, we'll say, a gigantic funhouse. The music that I play here is normally faster music, possibly music that the kids can sing along with. The building was originally a shoe factory. About 10 or 12 stories up, there's circulars to where they would throw the shoes when they were fixed them, and they would slide all the way down to the basement to where they were packaged, put on trucks, and sent to the stores. Well, those big slides are now slides for the kids to come in and slide all the way down. There's slides all over this building. The instrument that we're playing is a Wurlitzer Theater pipe organ, a 317, meaning there's three keyboards and 17 ranks of pipes, each rank holding about 61 pipes. In America, when we had the movies in the 1910s and 20s, these theaters would hire huge orchestras, maybe made of 25 or 30 people. They soon found out that hiring all these people for one movie got very expensive. And so a fellow by the name of Robert Hope Jones invented the theater pipe organ, meaning that one person can make all the different sound effects and the instruments of an entire orchestra. Well, the theaters love that because they're only paying one person to do the job of 30. As far as a pipe organ is concerned, when you hear a piano play, that's a real piano playing. If you hear a xylophone in a pipe organ, that's a real xylophone playing. They're real drums, and they're real cymbals, and they're real kettle drums, and real everything. It takes 17 brain functions to play a theater pipe organ. You've got both hands going. You've got your feet playing the foot pedals. I improvise quite a bit. I like to keep the music interesting. I might use a xylophone now, and in 10 minutes I might change it to a crystal clot. I might slow it down and use a beautiful piano, or I might speed it up and use a rinky-tink piano, honky-tonk piano. The organ is the entire orchestra, and the organist gets to do whatever he really wants to do.
Our final night in town, we're planning to record Seema and Prasanna Kasturi, who teach and play Indian classical music here in St. Louis. Only problem is, we don't have a venue. Our boat's bow isn't the ideal space for their setup. So Reed heads out on yet another bike reconnaissance mission, and soon enough, he finds the St. Paul Church in the Old North neighborhood. Terry Rose, the church treasurer, just happens to be around, and not only does she agree to host the session, she also offers to do our laundry, which is good, it's been a while. Come dusk, we're all back at the church, listening to Seema and Prasanna play and talk about the classical music of their home country.
There are only five notes.
Sa, ri, ga, pa.
Next octave.
Sa.
Same thing. So.
Sa ri ga pa ni. Sa. Sa ri ba ga ri sa.
So that is the scale.
Yes.
I'm really not, I don't have a script here. So, I see that basically one of the famous singers says he comes to a place like that, he says, So you look at, oh, that beautiful
ceiling.
Ceiling is very
elevation.
Beautiful. You're all sitting here. South Indian music is kind of very elaborately structured and planned. We have 12 notes. We have divided into 72 scales. So out of that, you have sub-ragas, child ragas. We have like almost like thousands of ragas.
So the entire song is set. But what we add on in the classical music is we add on what is called the manodharma, which means the creative music that aids to the entire raga dimension, which is, you know, the scale. So you build on to the scale using your emotions. Basically, you move from the you elaborate the raga structure, you could say that. So within that structure, you know, you get to use your freedom as long as you are within that scale.
That creativity you can have. You can always go and find your own melody. When I'm composing, I try to see for this combination of notes, and I ask a lot of my senior teachers, and they say it's not there. You can call your own name. Okay, call it reed raga. So it's not there, because what happens is it gets created.
We've really just begun to meet people and get a sense for St. Louis, and it'd be easy to stay much longer. record more musicians, see more neighborhoods, go to City Museum a dozen more times. But it's time to move on. In 5 weeks, we've got to be in New Orleans, and though the lower Mississippi is supposed to be much, much faster, that's still nearly 1,000 miles away. So we pull up our anchor and drift out of the city, back into the current.
And the time is 7:59, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Hi, this is John Shuck, host of Religion for Life, and this week we are going to explore... Hi, this is John Shuck, host of Religion for Life, and this week we are going to explore spiritual maturity, levels of faith, stages of faith, and my guest is Margaret Placentra Johnston. She's the author of Faith Beyond Belief, How Good People Have Left Their Church Behind. Find weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/religionforlife.
We were born before the wind.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Montevilla Jazz Festival, Saturday, August 15th and Sunday, August 16th at Portland Metro Arts. The Montevilla Jazz Festival showcases the best of Portland-based artists, including the Alan Jones Sextet, the Ed Bennett Quintet, Machete Order, and Portland Jazz Composers Ensemble, and many more. Again, that's the Montevilla Jazz Festival, Saturday, August 15th and Sunday.